and welcome to yet another episode of Hey, I Like, the podcast where we talk about all the things that make our little neurodivergent brains go bonkers. Thank you for coming back after our short break. But I am once again joined by one of my lovely friends. Would you like to introduce yourself and what you are talking about today?
Yep. Hello, I'm Arrow. I use she, her pronouns, and today we're going to be talking about animation history, which is very near and dear to my heart, because I love cartoons and I love history, so obviously cartoon history.
Oh, of course. Are we going to, at some point, talk about the fact that Steamboat Willie is now public domain and all the horrifying things that are inevitably going to happen to that poor mouse?
It sure is! I'm really excited about it. This is, like, insane. I mean, copyright history is, like, its own whole episode, honestly, because it's very dense and very insane. But, needless to say, I am glad that the company that will not be named is getting their dues. All right, so basically we're going to start from the very beginning, which is what exactly is animation, and it is a type of film, and film is basically when you take a bunch of pictures and put them together in a sequence, right? In a sequence that makes sense, whether it's through dialogue or usually some kind of movement. And like regular live action film is photographs of people or things doing movement in a sequence. But animation is the same thing, but with drawings or art or whatever you happen to be filming. I mean, there's different types of animation. We're going to focus on stuff that's drawn or artwork, basically. And we're also going to be focusing on American animation because that's where I live and that's where I've studied. So I am sorry. I know that there's other really interesting animation history in other parts of the world, for sure. So sadly, I am not that cool to be studying it. But it is also important to note that, like, animation and film in general is very much a collaborative effort. There's always going to be different people who contribute to it, because it's very much like a teamwork kind of project that, like, you need different people to produce and to edit and to draw and to voice, and you need a lot of different things. So there's really, I can't say that there's really one specific inventor of animation or film. It's really just that a bunch of different people contributed and put their own spin on it and basically made it what it is today. That's cool. So now that we've done that, let's see. So we are going to start. Okay, now that I've said that it is a collaborative effort, which a lot of people contribute. Now we're going to talk about the one guy who made 2,000 drawings in 2 years for one animated short, because he's insane. And that guy is Winsor McKay, my main man. I love him.
Same.
So Winsor McKay was a comic artist. He's most famous for a little comic strip called Little Nemo, which, as far as I can tell, is about a child who has super trippy dreams and goes on adventures. And it basically lent itself very well to animation, so, like, it makes sense. But, so Winsor McKay kind of made the logical jump from comic strips to animation. Little Nemo is from, like, the early 1900s. And then in 1914, he started doing this little show about Gertie the dinosaur. Gertie, my beloved. I love how the first like animal cartoon character was a dinosaur of all things. That is so funny. Like, we have cats and mice and dogs, but the dinosaur is where it started, man. That will never not be funny to me. Okay, so basically, in the early 1900s, animation was still kind of, well, a baby. It was not widespread popular yet. It was still sort of in its infancy, and people were still trying to figure out what the heck it was and what its entertainment value could be. But and for film also. So when the way that Gertie the Dinosaur worked is that they would project her film on a screen, and then Winsor McKay himself would stand up on the stage and he would sort of interact with Gertie. Like he would say, like, you know, sit, and Gertie would sit because that's how she was that's what she was animated to do. It was like a vaudeville sketch. It was a vaudeville skit, basically.
Yeah.
Because they didn't realize that, I mean, they didn't, that was just Winsor McKay kind of experimenting with what animation could do, and it was like a big hit because, you know, it's really cool to see an animated dinosaur interacting with a live man on stage. That was kind of cool. So Gertie took off, and so did all the other animators who were trying to get their feet wet in this new industry also took off doing these things. So the last Winsor McKay thing I want to talk about is that in 1918, he made a animated short about the sinking of the Lusitania. Yeah.
Yikes.
So 1918 was World War One, basically, and the Lusitania was a British ship, which also had a bunch of American passengers on it. But basically, the Lusitania was sunk by German submarines, and it was kind of a big catalyst for America getting involved in World War One. So the animated short about the Lusitania was sort of a propaganda piece to kind of like show how awful the Germans are and how we should get involved in the war and beat them because, you know, this ship sank. But it was also a marvel because, as I said, Winsor McKay is crazy and spent like 2 years on it drawing 2,000 frames by himself because he's nuts. Good times.
So
after, we're going to talk more about propaganda animation in the next war, so look forward to that. But before that, we have the interwar period, and so after World War One ends in 1918, and you have 1920s, and the 1920s is a fun time for animation. Because, as I said, it's still in its infancy. It's still getting started. People are still not entirely sure what to do with it. So they just did whatever the hell they wanted. Because there were no rules, you know? There was no, like, there were no censors. There was no, like, guidelines onto what exactly should be an animated film. So animators just kind of went nuts. And put the most wacky, trippy stuff you've ever seen in animation. And like, because basically in film, right, when you film something, you're limited by, you're limited in what you can actually do because you typically have human actors or animal actors, and they're just going to do what humans and animals do. And like, film is great and all. You can tell some great stories with film, but animation is basically just limited by what you can draw. So, yeah. And that kind of like unlimited creativity is what really draws me to it personally, because if you watch, you can find old cartoons from the 1920s on like YouTube and stuff, and they're just absolutely insane. Like, there's no physics, there's no rhyme or reason to them. It's just complete like abstract, trippy weirdness where everything has eyes and everything is anthropomorphized and everything is turning into something else. And there's like absolutely no story going on, but it's funny.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters. So it's just, it's,
I love that. I wish we could go back to that.
I know, right? I wish. Because like, there is definitely a charm to them. Like, even though they're wacky and make absolutely no sense, there's no storyline, there's no like coherent rhyme or reason to any of it, there is definitely something charming about early 1920s animation and how absolutely insane it is. It's great. I love it. It's so weird. So there's that. Let's talk about my next main man, which is Max Fleischer. Yay! I love Max Fleischer. He's very cool. So, Max Fleischer was most famous for creating characters like Betty Boop and Popeye. And he created them with, like, kind of the same idea about making, like, really wacky, insane cartoons with, like, a bit more focus on actual character. Because, like, Betty Boop and Popeye actually did have adventures, and they did do things that, like, actually kind of made sense.
Yeah.
But what Max Fleischer is really, really cool for, what I really admire him for, first of all, he was Jewish, which just makes my little Jewish heart happy. But yes. Also, he invented rotoscoping, which is so cool. Okay, so I'm going to get really technical here for a sec. Rotoscoping is basically the idea of tracing live-action footage and animating it. Because in early animation, it was really hard to get like a very smooth, fluid movement because you're taking individual pictures of drawings, right? It's really hard. It was really hard to get those drawings lined up exactly right. So there's like a smooth movement between each drawing. But Fleischer, with his rotoscoping technique, basically took live action footage and animated it. Like, he drew over it so that the animated characters had the exact same fluid movement as the live action people. And this made his animation so smooth and fluid and, like, human-like, basically.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly cool of him. And he also did other things, like using live action models for sets in his cartoons, which, like, gave it all, like, a very real look to them, a very unique look. Other inventions that came out at this time, a big one was the multiplane camera, which basically allows our animators to use different layers for their animation. So, like, instead of all the characters and backgrounds being on one layer, you can have the background be on a different layer, and that character just moves, the character moves on the layer above it, which is great because it gives you more movement with the character without having to change the background all the time. There were a lot of like really cool tricks that animators came up with to make animating easier, because animating is really, really hard.
It is, yeah.
It's really, really hard. Like, I love animation. My ADHD brain cannot do it. It requires so much precision and tedious repetition that, like, my brain literally cannot handle it. It's intense. It's very, very labor intensive work, and I really admire people who can do it, because it's hard.
Yeah,
it's really my hard.
One of my friends went to uni to study animation, and she now works. Obviously, the film industry's been really tough in the past sort of year or two. But she's been sort of working at various different companies. She did some of the VFX on Boba Fett.
Wow.
One of the films that she worked on got nominated for a BAFTA recently, so that was very exciting. Wow. But she's started working for Aardman a couple of weeks ago, which is really cool. Because I know you said you were focusing on American animation and stuff, but Aardman is one of the big studios in the UK.
Yes.
They do the like claymation.
Mm-hmm.
They did like Wallace and Gromit, Shaun the Sheep.
Yeah.
Those ones. Yeah, so she's working for them now, which is really cool. But yeah, I'm just constantly in awe of like everything that she does, because not only do you have to be good at art and, you know, draw the thing, you also then have to do all of the little individual steps, or like you have to make the model and like know how to move it in space so that it looks right and not really weird. Yeah, I'm not explaining it well, but like, there's a lot of technical stuff that they have to know how to do. So it's like, you're not just an artist, you are also like a computer scientist or a physicist, sort of, because you have to figure out when things are physically possible or not. And it's crazy, the stuff that they can do. I am very, very impressed.
I couldn't
do it either.
It's so
for a number
true.
Of reasons.
Yeah. It is, it really is an art. Like, the whole technical process is just insane. And, and like, there are ways, I mean, obviously over the years, there's been a lot of streamlining of the process. Like, now you have, like, artists working on very specific jobs, like in-betweeners and, ink and paint people whose job it is to color things in, and you have the pencilers and the in-betweeners and the inkers. So like, the process has been streamlined to make it easy on everybody, but it is very complicated. And I don't think the switch over to 3D has made it any easier. I think 3D animation has its own complicated technical process. So it's not like hand-drawn animation and 3D animation are like superior to one another. It's just that they're both just very different processes that both require a lot of skill. Anyway, I cannot talk about animation history without mentioning the company that must not be named. So that's what we're doing. Hello, Disney. Okay, so in 1928, we have Steamboat Willie, and Steamboat Willie is the important cartoon for several reasons. The first of which being that it is the first cartoon to introduce Mickey Mouse to the public. Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
So there were cartoon characters like Mickey before, obviously. There was Felix the Cat, there was Bimbo the Dog, there was Betty Boop. There were a lot of characters that existed before Mickey, but Mickey had a kind of charm that he became like a mascot. He became like Disney's big thing. So he would go on to charm millions. But and he also had like a very simple design. There was a lot of things about Mickey that took off specifically, but with Steamboat Willie, the biggest thing about Steamboat Willie was that it had sound. It had synchronized sound. And this was a big deal in 1928, because before this, basically animated shorts, they were usually like 5 to 7 minutes long, and they would play in theaters. The idea being that like, you would go for the main event, which was like the live action film that Hollywood put out. And before that, you'd have like a little cartoon to just kind of tide you over, similar to what Disney does these days, where they have like those little Pixar shorts.
I love the little Pixar shorts.
They're so cute.
I remember seeing the Sandpiper one for the first time, and it like that was the first time I'd ever seen one of them, and I was just like, oh my god, that's so cute. I have not seen one that's quite as good since, I don't think, but I'm very, very nostalgic for cute animals. So.
they are cute. You should try to find the other ones. They're really well done. I think they're on Disney Plus. Anyway, but yeah, that whole tradition originates from pretty early on, when cartoons would play in front of like big movies. And you would usually have, the cartoons were silent, of course, because all films were silent in the early 1920s, and you would usually have a guy plunking out a tune on a piano while the cartoon played. That's where you would get sound from. But Steamboat Willie had synchronized sound, which is very cool, because this way you have music that is in tune with the animation itself. So not only do you have Mickey like dancing around to the song, you have Mickey like on beat with the song. Like, he is in a rhythm. There is like a smooth rhythm with the music. And this is like really, really important, because it cemented the relationship between sound and image. And music would come to play a really big part in film, right? Like, the soundtrack to a film is so, so important, and especially important in cartoons, when you could have a character that could do basically anything, and it's in tune to the music. It's really important. Steamboat Willie was a big deal. Everybody loved it. Even though it had basically no plot, but the technical achievements was what really sold it to everybody, that like, wow, this is synchronized sound. And it was just a big deal. So, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
That is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. I love Steamboat Willie. It is weird and wacky and beautiful. and it's also public domain now, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me is that this is not the first time that something Disney related has become public domain. But every single time it happens, the first thing people make with it is like some kind of horror.
I know.
It's film, so, and it's like, why?
It's
such a twist.
I think the last thing to go public domain was Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
But like the original Winnie the Pooh, not the Disney version, the book version. But like somebody immediately made a horror movie out of it.
I know.
Like, why though? It's so ridiculous. I love it. Okay. So next up in our timeline was that revolutionizing animation with sound wasn't enough for Disney. He wanted to do more. So, okay, say what you will about Walt Disney. He was a complicated person, blah, blah, blah. But he was kind of a genius when it came to characters, in that he saw that all the cartoons in the early 20s and mid-30s had no story. They were very fun. They were very wacky. They were nonsensical. They were technically impressive. But you couldn't really get into them the way you would get into, like, a full-length Hollywood movie. There was no depth to them. There was no conflict, really. It's just that, like, characters did silly things to make you laugh, and then that was it. Walt Disney really wanted... He believed that characters could be more than, you know, silly talking animals. He wanted to see, like, real drama and conflict in animation. That's why he made Snow White. In 1937, which was the first full-length animated film ever, I think, at least in America. And rumor has it that in its opening, like, thousands of children pissed themselves in the theater because Snow White is scary. It's really scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. Because, I mean, to be fair, it was not specifically geared towards children. It was geared towards anybody who wanted to come see an animated feature. But Snow White was like, it was complicated. It had depth. It had character design, like character interactions that were interesting. It had scary moments. It had sad moments. It had funny moments. It had a little bit of everything. It was like a real feature film that Hollywood would have made, but it was made by Disney. And I think he won the Oscar for it that year in 1937, and also got like 7 smaller Oscars, like for the dwarves, which is just very cute. So that was very cool. And like Disney's Snow White kind of opened the floodgates for everybody else to try their hand at more dramatic, more interesting and intense animation. So that is kind of cool. Okay, so we're out of the 30s. Let's talk about World War II, which is not very fun to talk about usually, but I have a lot of feelings about World War II. So film was still in its infancy in the 30s, but people were just starting to realize how popular it was. I think that the number of people who went to theaters like peaked in the 30s and 40s because people were so enamored with film and its possibilities. And governments realized how enamored people were with film and were like, we could use this for state goals. And they did. And that's how Hollywood went to war. Including all the cartoon characters, they also went to war. So suddenly, all of these animation companies were coming out with propaganda, basically. And not just American ones either. All over the world, animation companies were creating animated propaganda to kind of entice the masses into their particular goals, supporting the war, not supporting these people. You ended up having a lot of racism in these animated shorts because, you know, them versus us. And that's, anyway, but that is how you get, that is how you get Donald Duck saying Heil Hitler over and over again, which is a cartoon that you can find on YouTube. It is very dear to my heart. I love that cartoon. It's called
We Have, so my dad has a, like, server / hard drive. Well, I have a hard drive, he has a server with, like, thousands and thousands of films on it, because he used to just go to the library, get the DVD, and then like burn it onto the computer. So we have all of the Disney shorts from that era, I think.
Oh my god, no
we
way.
Have a load of the World War II stuff. We have the weird like vagina adverts. Yeah, we have the one with the planes. I haven't seen most of them, but we have like all of them.
I want it. I want to see it so badly. That sounds so fun, because a lot of them are up on YouTube, but you have to know what to look for, and not all of them are there. So I would love that. That sounds so fun, because they're just so treasured. They're very important to me. Anyway, moving on before I get sappy. So it was not only Americans who sent their cartoon characters to war, so to speak. The Nazis also did. I'm just going to go on a brief tangent here and say that the Nazis made animated cartoons with all of their fascist and anti-Semitic qualities. And you can find them on YouTube also. Like, just disturbingly easy to find them on YouTube. But okay, so I wrote about Nazi animation for my undergrad thesis paper, and to this day I am still incredibly bitter that my professor, whose entire job it is to study German film from the Nazi period, did not know that there were cartoons produced during this time, and I'm mad about it, because it just shows that, like, cartoons are not appreciated as much as they should be as cultural artifacts.
Wasn't Disney, like, one of the only foreign films that wasn't banned in Nazi Germany?
Briefly.
Or am I misremembering that?
It was not banned briefly, but negotiations eventually fell through. I mean, to be fair, the only Disney film existent at the time was Snow White. But yeah, it was complicated. They had a complicated relationship. This is a whole thing. I am very passionate about animation during World War II. It is insane, and I love it. So aside from, like, propaganda cartoons aimed towards making people want to go to war and stuff, animation also ended up being useful in education, because with animation, you could basically make illustrations and diagrams come to life, and you could more easily show how a tool or a weapon works. And you kind of needed that, because in World War II, there was a lot of really advanced warfare all of a sudden, like tanks and planes and anti-aircraft guns, and soldiers needed to know how to use that, and a lot of the soldiers were young. So animation proved to be very useful in showing soldiers how to do it, and it proved to be a very, very powerful education tool, which is something we will see again later. So it's not just for entertainment purposes, but it also ended up being used in education and in wartime for similar things. The 40s marks the golden age of film and animation in general, because that was when, like, the studios were at their peak. After the war ends, things get a little dicey, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Enter the 1950s. Okay, so the 1950s was a lot of things happened, but maybe the biggest thing that happened for our purposes is the advent of television. Yay! I have mixed feelings about television.
I can tell.
Okay, so television brings entertainment directly into your home, right? You don't need to go out to the theater anymore. You can just watch it on the couch. How cool is that? I mean, you could do that now, even with streaming, but anyway, the point is that, television was a big deal. It was cheap to, television was cheap. It did not require, like, the big, like, what's the word I'm looking for? TV did not require the big over-the-top production values that Hollywood was used to making. Television could be made cheaply. It was on a small screen. It was still black and white. It was very profitable for people who made television. So, and everything kind of, and everything that went on the television kind of was cheap. So, I mean, not everything, but like in the beginning when television was still early and still figuring out what it wanted to be, everything was kind of cheap. So cartoons made for television became cheap. So with television, you have the rise of commercials. I mean, you had commercials before, like on the radio and in the theater, but now you have visual commercials on the TV that you can blast out to millions of families across the country, which is insane. So this is when you get the rise of, like, animated mascots in commercials. And again, these were pretty cheaply done, but they were catchy. They had that, you know, those little tunes, they had, like, those fun jingles that everybody gets stuck in their brain. And that was sort of what animation was used for when it came to television. And in general, you also had another animation studio that rose up at this time was the UPA. It's called United Productions of America. Yeah, that's super creative.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Exactly what I was expecting.
Yeah, so the UPA made, what did they do? They made the Pink Panther and Mr. Magoo series, and they were known for having very simplified animation. Like, I think it's very charming in its own way, but it's very, like, geometric, simplified, like, very much a focus on line art kind of design, as opposed to, like, old Disney animation, which is, like, beautifully lush with, like, cell shading and very vividly animated. UPA was kind of a callback to, like, a more very simpler animation style, which is, you know, it's a take for people who are into that. I think it's very cute and charming, but, you know.
Okay, Panther. Fucking slaps, Arrow. Don't diss the Pink Panther. That soundtrack was like the soundtrack to the little kids' Pony Club musical ride every single summer. I have so I love it so much. I don't think I've ever actually seen the film, but like the music is just it is perfect.
I'm so sorry for triggering a very specific childhood memory.
I mean, I never did that musical ride, but I watched like 5 successive years of children do it. So we got to pick our own music. The 6-year-olds did not.
Okay. That is completely fair. So, yes. Wow. Whew. Yeah. So the 1950s is complicated because on the one hand you have like some interesting animation choices spawning from it. You also have like, for example, Rocky and Bullwinkle, which is a unique show in that it also had political messaging in it because it was kind of centered on the Cold War, you know, with the Russian spy villains and stuff. So that was a thing. But on the other hand, to television, television just ruined theaters, ruined the entire theater industry, and it also kind of gave rise to the idea that cartoons are made for children, and that bugs the hell out of me, because cartoons are not just made for children. Cartoons could be made for everyone if you just put your head out of your butts. But that's just me. I personally have beef with the 1950s and the way they kind of childified animation. Like,
no, I agree with you.
You might be asking, wait, what was Disney doing during this time? And Disney was still making movies. I believe they made Cinderella during this time. But mostly at this point, Walt Disney was focused on making Disneyland. And he fully took advantage of television, mostly through live action shows, however. He made a whole show about the building of Disneyland. That was sort of his main focus during the 1950s. Because he kind of realized that, like, you know, our golden age is done. Still making animated movies, but now we're going to focus on Disneyland and television because that's where the money is. So also during the 1950s was like the McCarthy era. So there was a lot of political crap going on in Hollywood, which made it very difficult for everybody to work in like a stable environment because the McCarthy era was kind of insane and very bad for actors and animators and people who wanted to stay working. So
yeah,
that was a lot. The 1950s are a lot, and I'm not happy about it. All right, so on to the next decade. Yeah, 1960s. Ah, good times in 1960s. Well, no, well, not really, because Walt Disney died in 1966. So after Walt Disney dies, Disneyland is up and running and very cool and all. But Walt Disney died when he was still in the middle of making Disney World in Florida. So that was still kind of the focus of the company, even at the time of his death. And even then, there was kind of a creative slump when it came to the animated films that they were known for. They kind of went downhill from there a little bit. Not making so many movies, not making so many good movies. Instead, we have some other animated stuff coming out, like my personal childhood, which is Hanna-Barbera. They were a duo animation company who made things like Scooby-Doo and the Flintstones and the Jetsons.
Oh my god!
Exactly! I grew up on this stuff, but it's like, oh my god. And like, you watch it now as an adult, and it's like, wow, the animation is horrible. It's so cheap. It's so, so bad. But they had like the budget of like a sandwich. Like, they were working with nothing.
They did their best.
They did their best with what they had, and they reuse animation. They cut corners. You can see the edges of frames. It's just. But you know what? There's a reason that Scooby-Doo is still kicking even today, and Flintstones is still on cereal boxes, and that is that they were good cartoons. They were funny. They had interesting characters. They had interesting premises. They were fun, and they stuck in your mind. And I'm not saying you have to have like amazing like Disney-style animation in order to be a good cartoon. For sure not. They were still very well done. It's just that, like, these are different styles of animation that are still being created. Even after Disney already had their golden age, other animators are still coming up and being like, hey, but what if we did it this way? And then they did it. Even if their animation budget was so tiny, it makes me cringe internally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good times. In addition to Hanna-Barbera and their lovely, lovely work, you also had really, really wacky hippie stuff coming out because this is the flower power age. So, have you ever seen The Yellow Submarine?
I have heard of it. I know the song.
Well, yeah, it's a Beatles song, and it is an animated movie about the Beatles, kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
It's basically a bunch of Beatles music videos that are animated and strung together with very little plot. It is the trippiest.
That's what I'd heard.
Yeah, it is extremely trippy. I mean, it's the 1960s and, like, distilled into 2 hours of animation.
Yeah.
It is nuts. I watched it as a kid. I loved it. I love Beatles music because of that movie. It is nuts. It's basically, it's like a callback to the night, to like the 1920s wackiness. But it's focused on the Beatles, and I'm still really mad that the Beatles themselves did not actually voice themselves in that movie.
Really?
I know, right? I mean, obviously they did the music because, like, it's their songs, but, like, they should have voiced themselves. It would have been really funny. Anyway, right, so you had really wacky hippie stuff like Yellow Submarine and also Sesame Street, which obviously Sesame Street is puppets, but there is also animation in there.
Yes.
And this is where you get the idea of what they would later call edutainment, which is, you know, animation built for educating children. So, like,
yeah,
you have a lot. It's still very wacky, trippy animation, but it's also, like, showing kids how to count and showing kids different letters. And that way animation was also utilized in a very specific style.
I have so much appreciation for Sesame Street.
Yes,
yeah, Sesame, like, Street. Like, so much.
It is, yeah. I watched the Israeli version as a kid, which is similar, but it's just, I learned Hebrew instead of English from it. It's a weird, weird experience, but, and then I, like, grew up and then watched the actual Sesame Street and is like, oh, just different characters.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the 1960s, where you get the rise of edutainment and new styles and Disney not being very good at what they're supposed to do. I'm bitter about Disney. I don't know if you could tell. But, okay, so next decade, nothing really happened in the 70s that I could find. The 70s are boring in terms of animation history. Disney is still in their creative slump, so they're not really doing anything particularly interesting. I would say the most important animated film to come out of the 70s was a little thing called Fritz the Cat. It's kind of an underground, kind of was an underground hit. I think it's still kind of obscure today, but basically it's one of the first adult animated films. And when I say adult, I mean, like, really, really adult. Like, it's based on an arc rom-com. Like, it's very sexualized. It's very out there. But it is kind of a watershed moment for, in terms of, hey, maybe animation isn't just for kids. Like, maybe animation could be used to tell, like, darker stories and appeal to adults. I haven't actually seen this movie. I don't want to see this movie, but it is important in terms of paving the way for future adult-oriented cartoons like The Simpsons and Family Guy and South Park. So that seems like kind of an important moment in animation history to point out. Okay, now let's talk about, and then you get to the 1980s, which is where one of my personal favorite movies ever comes out, which is called Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It is a Disney movie, but it wasn't really released under Disney's name because they were pussies. It is definitely a darker movie. So the thing about Who Framed Roger Rabbit is that it is both animated and live action, which is interesting. There are not too many movies that actually do that, especially today. But back in early animation, like really, really early, before the 1920s or during the 1920s, you had a lot of mixes of animation and live action because I guess it was easier to film like live footage and then animate over it, like draw things interacting with the human characters.
Yeah.
So I love Who Framed Roger Rabbit because it's kind of a callback to that, where you have cartoon characters, like, really interacting with live-action people, because that's really hard to do. Like, can you imagine, like, having to act with actors that are not there. You still need to react to everything they're supposedly doing. Like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is just nuts from multiple perspectives, especially from a technical perspective, because it was really insane in how they managed to have cartoon characters interact with real-world objects. I mean, you have cartoon characters holding real-world guns. Like, they had to, they had to rig up those guns to float in the air so that it looks like cartoon characters are holding them.
Whoa!
The detail in that movie is nuts, but it's also a fun movie. It's like it's a mystery. It's a detective story. It's a murder mystery, obviously. And it's dark. It's gritty. It's silly. I'm obsessed with it. I love that movie so much. And again, you know who worked on this movie? Steven Spielberg worked on this movie. That's when you know.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. It's also the only movie where you will ever see Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse on the same screen together, because Spielberg managed to negotiate Warner Bros. Into putting their characters into a Disney movie. which is something that only Spielberg could accomplish, honestly, because they hate each other. I think the deal was is that Warner Bros. Would let their characters be in the movie as long as they got perfectly equal screen time with the Disney characters, which is, like, so incredibly petty of them. And I appreciate it. But it's a great film for many, many reasons, and that is one of them. And again, it is an example of cartoons starting to be taken more seriously. Like, hey, maybe animation doesn't have to be for kids. Maybe we can do something different with them and actually do something interesting and fun. Yeah, so that's it for that. Next decade! Woo! We're getting there. We're almost done. I promise. Okay, so the 1990s was a big deal because of the Disney Renaissance.
This is the weird era, isn't it?
I mean, depends how you define weird. But was it weird? I don't know. I think in the mid-90s, Disney was experimenting a little, which is how you get films like Lilo and Stitch.
That was when they bought Pixar, so they poured all their money into Pixar, and the 2D animators could just do whatever they liked.
Pretty much, yeah. 2D animators did whatever they liked.
My favorite Disney films.
Yes, exactly. You got some weird... Disney had a little bit of a weird era when they were experimenting a little bit, because they had just taken on Pixar, and Pixar was experimenting a little bit. But basically, the Disney Renaissance is films like The Little Mermaid and The Lion King and Aladdin and Mulan, like what we grew up with, basically, like really, really classic Disney movies that, like,
yes,
universally loved. Like, everybody loves that. Lion King and Aladdin are still on Broadway. Like, it was a big deal. It was really, really a big deal. And Disney had been in a creative slump since the 60s, and 30 years later, they finally got their shit together and are making good animated movies again. Wow! Amazing! In addition to Disney, like, doing their taking over the entire animation industry again, you also have, more styles coming out, such as Pixar, which makes the first 3D animated film in 1995, which is Toy Story. That was a big deal. And you also have things like The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was like a very popular stop motion animated movie. You also have people like Don Bluth, who is doing his own like weird, dark 2D animated film. So the 90s are kind of not just a renaissance for Disney, but for animation in general, where you suddenly have a bunch of new styles and films and companies kind of coming out of the woodwork and putting their own stamp on the industry. Yes, good times, the 90s. Good times.
Yes.
Makes me happy. And yeah, I mean, I did not grow up in the 90s. I was born in 2000, but that was my childhood. Like, my siblings were all 90s kids, right? So everything that they had, I inherited. So I kind of grew up on 90s stuff. Like, this is my Disney. This is the Disney that I remember growing up with, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, I was born in 99, but everything that started in the States in the 90s didn't hit the UK until at least 5 years later. I don't know why this happened, but like, you know, when you see things on the internet where they're like, you know, you're a 90s kid if, and then they list all these things, and it's like, those were all things in the UK in the early 2000s, and especially in like working to middle classes, it got there even later. So most of the stuff that I grew up with is stuff from the 90s, even though, like, I don't remember really anything before about 2003 or four.
Yeah.
I have some background in US, like, kids shows, because before we moved to the UK, I was living on US military bases, so... So, you know, like, I was watching, like, PBS shows until the age of about five, but you know, like, most of the stuff in the UK that I grew up with was stuff from the 90s in the US, but
that is so interesting.
Yeah, it's really odd.
Yeah,
it's really strange. It's like everything in the UK was like 5 years behind the States, at least. Other than like music, but then there was nothing around the turn of the decade. So all the stuff from the 90s was still on the radio when I was growing up, and they were treating it like it was brand new and cool and like hip and everything. And it's just like,
that's so
okay.
Funny. Oh my
okay.
God.
But no, my first Disney movie. The first movie that I remember watching, really, was Fantasia.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Because my parents were taken in by all the scientific studies that said that if your baby or kid listened to a lot of classical music, they'd be smarter.
Oh my God. That's
so they were like, this entire movie is just classical music with pictures.
It is. Oh,
it's beautiful, though. I love it so much.
Fantasia is old. It's from 1940, but it was one
of
the.
Yeah, but they did a second one in.
They did in 2000, yeah.
Yeah, Fantasia 2000. And that's also really good, so.
It is, yeah. The original Fantasia was, like, Walt Disney's, like, personal pet project. Like, that was his baby. He loved Fantasia. He just... It was, like, his, like, personal self-indulgent thing about mixing classical music together with animation. And the results are stunning. Like, it's a gorgeous movie. Maybe not the best movie to release right before a war breaks out, but, you know, in hindsight. It's gorgeous. I love Fantasia. It's really funny.
Love it so much.
Yeah.
I get the two muddled up because... Like, I think I watched them both at about the same time, like, back to back.
Yeah, that's fair.
But I remember my sibling being terrified of the Night on Bald Mountain bit.
Oh my God, for sure.
Which is terrifying. Like, it's objectively terrifying.
it is. It's supposed to be. That's what's great about it.
We both, like, unanimously hated the one with the dinosaurs. because it was sad because all the dinosaurs die. But I rewatched it a couple of years ago, and the one with the centaurs and the like the Pegasi and the Greek gods and stuff. I can't remember what music is in the background. I used to know all of the songs off by heart, but no, that one, it's just like, it's so trippy. It's so weird.
It's so weird. Fantasia
it's so,
was
like weirdly sexualized. It's just bizarre.
Fantasia was just like, it was Walt Disney's personal baby. It was his self-indulgent pet project. So he made it with it, like, keeping in mind, it was for an audience of one, which was Walt Disney. Like, he really wanted to make that movie.
No, I get that, but also it is so weird to watch. The Sorcerer's Apprentice is fantastic, though.
It is. It's so good.
That's just, oh my God. It's beautiful. And then there's a bit, like, midway through, I can't remember if this is Fantasia or Fantasia 2000, but there's a bit midway through where they do a segment that's basically all about, like, music.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, music theory and the physics behind music and, like, how we hear things.
And that's so cool.
And they have an orchestra and they show the conductor. And then they have this animated stuff in the background that shows, like, the sound waves with the music. It's so cool. I'm like, I want to find that clip. And if I ever have to teach a music lesson about, like, sound.
You should find it and send it to me.
Oh, my God, it's brilliant. It's like, it explains it so well, and like, it's just very, it's because it's not like they're not telling a story with the music like they are with the other pieces. They're like explaining exactly how everything works, and it's just, that's really fascinating to me.
That is interesting. If you find that clip, please send it to me. I'm very curious.
It's in one of the two films, so you can go and watch that.
I could be wrong. It sounds like it was in 2000, but...
I feel like it was probably 2000, because the original one would have been too long ago to have it.
Exactly.
It's like the stuff with the actual, like, live-action people in is all in colour, and I feel like the 40s, that probably would not have been a thing yet. So,
I don't remember
when America got color TV in the UK. It was the 60s. So.
Okay, fair.
And like the late 60s.
I have an anecdote about the making of Night on Bald Mountain. There was like exactly one animator responsible for the devil in that short. Which was Bill Titla, and there's like an anecdote about him like literally hunched over his desk late at night, like in the dark, working on that. Which is just very accurate.
Yes.
Yeah, there's another anecdote that all the animators hated the conductor. Like, he was, like, apparently really pretentious and snobby. Walt Disney loved him. Like, they were besties, but all the other animators just, like, hated his guts.
I love that so much.
It's fun. It's fun. Yeah, so that was a fun tangent.
It was a very fun tangent.
Good times. Good times. All right, so we just finished the 90s, which is... Disney Renaissance and general animation renaissance of fun stuff happening. In the 2000s, which is when I was alive and you were alive.
I was alive.
Yay.
Just about.
So I think obviously there was a lot of important animated films. I think for our purposes, the most important animated films was Shrek in the year 2000. I love Shrek. It was literally my childhood, and it's basically it broke Disney's hold on fairy tales, which I think is very like
it is.
Shrek was like the first fairy tale movie to be not Disney and also good. Like, like fairy tales lend themselves very well to animated adaptations, but Shrek, like, you know, takes the fairy tale tropes and turns them on their head, and there's still a happy ending, right? It's about an ogre who still gets his happily ever after. Like, I know it's great to like beam on Shrek, and like that's just our generation being our generation.
Yes.
But it's also like a great movie, okay? It's like
I don't know. It is. I just I was ruined for life by the memes in secondary school. And all the idiotic all the idiotic boys coming into school and going on about Shrek is love, Shrek is life that they'd seen on YouTube. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I can tell I'm not going to like it.
Exactly. Yeah, so, like, memes aside, it was a really, it's a really, really good movie. Like, it's not just for kids. It does have, like, adult ideas, and it has good music, it's fun, it's silly, it's a good movie. It's a good movie, okay?
It is. And it's one of those movies where, like, every time you watch it, you pick up on a different stupid joke that you didn't catch the first time.
Exactly.
That, like, the puns and the adult humor that you missed when you were 7 and watched it for the first time.
Exactly. And that's what's great about, I mean, all of these things kind of build on nostalgia a little bit, right? I mean,
yeah.
Like, but every time you, like, go back to watch, like, a really good movie or book or whatever, you start to see things that you didn't notice before. As you grow older, which is, like, contributes to, like, the timelessness of good media. Anyway, so Shrek is great. It also signifies the rise of DreamWorks.
Yes.
DreamWorks got big in the 2000s and actually became a really big rival for Disney, which was impressive.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the 2000s. Now we're up to the future. I mean, there is the 2010s, which I guess is when Frozen came out. So I guess that's a big deal, maybe? I don't know.
I have Frozen was beef with Frozen.
Oh, no. Do tell. No,
I mean, most of it is that I've been working in schools since 2017.
That's off and on.
But also, I mean, there's several reasons for me to personally have many, many issues with Frozen, one of which is that it's supposedly based on the Snow Queen, but there is basically no similarity at all to the Snow Queen, but because really? Disney owns the copyright, no one else can make it, and as a sort of Danish person, I take personal offense at that.
Oh, like, yeah, that's fair.
Please let somebody do it properly, for the love of God. But also, yeah, the thing with the kids being incredibly annoying about all the songs. But also, like, it came out in the same year as Rise of the Guardians, which I feel like is a really overlooked film.
That is fair.
And there are similar main characters.
Oh, God.
And it's like, ooh.
Oh, that's rough.
But no, it's mostly the fact that nobody can ever make another film about the Snow Queen now, which is objectively, like, would be a really good fairy tale to make an animated film out of, and now Disney's ruined it for everybody.
Oh, man. They're
in the copyright to the fairy tale. No one can make it.
Ugh, Disney. I have so many issues with them. It's really hard to love animation and not be, like, and not run into Disney all the time, because they have such a freaking monopoly on it, and it's really, it's upsetting, because, like, there's so many other great animation studios out there. There's, like, especially back to our timeline, especially with the rise of the internet and, like, all of this animation software that is free or affordable, and now people on the internet can make animation and get money from it via the internet. And, like, there's this whole, and, you know, there's, like, the era of flash animation and indie animation and all of these people suddenly coming out of the woodwork and being like, hey, look at my wacky stick figures moving around and doing stuff. Like, that, the internet also has been, like, amazing for animation in, like, kind of democratizing the whole thing and making people realize, hey, I can do this too. And that's what they're doing, which is
fantastic.
It's also the rise of fandom, especially particularly online fandom, which gives people a better chance to talk about these things and to discuss animation and, like, get together and talk about animation and make fan art and fan fiction. And, like, I think fandom is, like, really a big reason why so many animated stuff today does so well is because now adults are actually, like, talking about it. I don't think Steven Universe would have done so well if it hadn't come out during a time when fandom was so big. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I haven't seen Steven Universe. I think it's an amazing...
I haven't either.
I've heard that it's a great show, but just, like, the sheer amount of traction it gets just from fandom years after it was released is kind of incredible.
I know. You know? It's the same with, like, Gravity Falls and, like, Avatar and stuff. Oh, I went to see the Avatar concert.
Ooh, that sounds like...
It's so good. It's yeah. so good. They've announced more dates now, but back when I got the tickets, I still don't know if they're actually doing more in the UK, but when I got my ticket for it, they were doing one night in London, and it was wow. the first night that they were doing the concert. They started it in London, did one night in London, then they went to Paris and did one night in Paris, and they were going like around all the other countries and returning to the States, and they were going to the States last. So I was at, like, opening night of this concert. They were in London for one night only, and I went, and the entire theatre was full. There were no empty seats, and everybody there was between the ages of, like, 20 and 30.
That's amazing.
It was fantastic.
Wow.
I've never been to any show in a theatre that caters to such a specific demographic. It was brilliant.
Oh wow, it really does. Yeah, I love Gravity Falls, and there's like a new book about it coming out, and like I think that the reason that shows like Gravity Falls and Steven Universe and Over the Garden Wall and Avatar the Last Airbender they're so good, and they have such extreme longevity now because of their fandom. Their fans
yes.
are still
also just
it.
Because they hold up really well on like they have such good rewatch value.
They also do hold up really well and have great rewatch value.
I rewatch Over the Garden Wall every year.
Yep.
Every year.
I watched it. It was personally not my thing, but like, you know, different strokes. But yeah, it's just so cool.
I mostly watch it because it's really pretty.
It is really pretty, that's true.
Backgrounds are just beautiful. I can appreciate good art, I just can't draw it. But also, like, I think it's mostly because, like, I watched it the first time, and I got through, like, the first couple of episodes and was like, this is a bit stupid. Like, it's a little bit too young for me.
Right.
And was about to turn it off. And then I got to the episode where there's the plot twist.
Ooh.
And was like, oh, okay. There's, like, it wasn't even really a plot twist. I think I just noticed, like, midway through that the way that the screen had been, like, shaded made it look like someone was watching them through binoculars.
Oh.
And I was just like, oh, my gosh. I have to know what happens. He's watching them. And it, it was crazy. And it's, like, ooh, I think it was when you realize that suddenly, like, it's pretending to be a really silly little kids show.
And then it's not.
And it's not. And it completely threw me. I don't know what I was expecting. It was not that.
Yeah, it's great.
It's wonderful. And it's really short, which means that you can watch it in one day.
Right. So,
unlike the really long shows that take like a week.
Yeah, that's a lot. So I'm at the end of my timeline. We're at the present.
Yeah.
So that was my spiel on animation history and all of my feelings about it and about cartoons. And
it's been wonderful.
Thank you so much. We had such fun discussion.
Yes, I love animation. I love animated films and shows and all of that. I just didn't know like any of the history. I just like watching them. We didn't get to talk about How to Train Your Dragon, and we talked about DreamWorks. This is a crime.
I know. There's so
that
much to talk about.
That film is stunning.
Yes, and my knowledge is by no means comprehensive. I mean, I just do this as a hobby. And because it's fun.
I mean, the same for all of us, really. I think the only there's been a couple of episodes where it's like, ah, yes, this is, you know, like either this is my job or this is something that I studied at university. There's only been a few episodes where it's been like that. The rest of the time it has literally just been, I really like learning about this thing. I'm going to tell all of you about
it. Yeah. That is what the podcast is for.
Basically, yeah.
I love it. Okay, so thank you so much for having me. That was a lot of fun.
It's so much fun. I love talking with people about stuff.
Yeah, it's great. You're a great host. We love you.
Oh, thank you. You are great to have on. But yeah, so thank you for coming and talking about animation stuff, because I love animation stuff and I know you do too, and it's really fun. Yeah, next. Our next episode, I think, is going to be Lord of the Rings with Tom. So we are returning to our Tolkien series, which is very exciting. We are back to our normal upload schedule. So we are now every 2 weeks, fortnightly, bi-weekly, whatever you want to call it. Please don't get confused. It is every 2 weeks. It is not twice a week. Twice a week would kill me.
We don't want to kill Jess. She does everything around here.
Give us money via Patreon. We have no patrons. One day. But yeah, so I guess that is all for now, I guess.
Yeah.
We will see you. See our lovely listeners in 2 weeks. But yeah, so I guess it is goodbye from me.
Yeah. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
Yes, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've made it all the way to the end, congrats! You're officially much stronger than half of our friends. If you're enjoying listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you get notified when we update, or sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/hey_i_like, where you have a direct line to us, the creators. You can also follow us on Tumblr at heyilike, which is all lowercase. That's all for now. See you next time on Hey, I Like.